put on your desk, have you on your desk, a couple of things here. What is sacramental marriage? Matrimony. I want you to take these home. I want you to read them. They're essentially the notes for tonight. And a lot of details about natural family planning. I put this together years ago with guidance from Jean and her husband. You'll notice their names on the top. I don't know. So you've got a contact right here in the room on how to do the natural family planning. And years ago, I went to their home and did the little course. What was it? Just one night. I cannot tell you how that changed my life. It was really significant. By that point, I'd already done all the sins and all of that stuff. But I was moved to the point where I thought, no, I've got to get this right. And I did. And quite frankly, they didn't do a whole lot of evangelizing. They just taught how it was done. And in the reading and whatnot that they provided and this listening, it totally moved me at the wonder and awe of our bodies. Because we are created in God's image. And that, in and of itself, is a beautiful thing. And if you just focus on that, and what it takes to either get the very, all the things that have to line up in order for a woman to get pregnant, you got to know then that God exists and He is part of our fertility.
They were just going about their business, just being faithful Catholics, and they had a couple of married or engaged couples there, and then there was me,
premenopausal. But it is so moving, and that's the other point. It's never too late to figure this out, unless you are menopausal. It's never too late to figure this out. So if you've already figured, oh, my kids are done and whatnot, still do this, ladies. And
Jean and Chris did help us out with marriage prep a little bit too. We were teaching marriage prep at the Archdiocese for a while. Okay, we just had one more slide that we didn't. So parents have the first right and duty to educate their children. The family is the first and vital cell of society.
So as the family goes, so goes society. So do we want to have a strong, healthy, generous, peaceful society? That's the kind of families we need.
It's firstly the place of experiencing and transmitting fundamental human values of acceptance, service, solidarity, service. Oh, have that twice. And thus, I guess so. And thus contributes to human formation for community. The family is educated and formed by the church. In turn, it is a sign of Christ's love and communicates this love. And having accepted the gospel itself, the family becomes an evangelizing community. Okay, so that was just one or two slides that we didn't get to.
Your money's worth tonight.
Okay, yeah. So we're just open to talking about any. We touched on so many things, and we would love to talk more. But what do you most want to talk about?
Can I just get you to tell us about the different words for love?
I didn't do that one. Do you want to do it yourself?
I'll start.
Okay. So every year the presentation we do is different, and usually we do include this one. Since love has to cover a lot of things in our society, we will say, I love pizza, I love chocolate, I love my dog, I love sunny days, I love my husband.
I made the list.
I love God. And I don't mean the same kind, hopefully, I don't mean the same kind of love. And so it has to cover way too many things. So the ancient Greeks had four words for love, different types of love.
So the one word that the Greeks used for love, storge. So this is the kind of love that binds a family together. It's an affection. The second word,
philia.
And this is like brotherly or friendship love. Like Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love. And then the third type, the one that Hollywood is most enamored of, is Eros. And this, of course, is the root word for erotic. And this is a sensual
desire.
But desire,
passion, romance.
Passion, romance, all that. And Pope Benedict described it as an ascending love because it, you know, takes us to the heights. And so people desire this kind of love because the experience of it is very rewarding. And it's usually the first kind of love that we fall into when we meet our beloved. This isn't the love that comes by choice. It's the love that happens to us. And then the third is agape or agape.
The fourth.
That's what I mean. Math was never my strong suit. And it's a descending love, Pope Benedict describes it as, because it means I'm willing to stoop down and serve. And it's a choice of the will, it's sacrifice, and it's most beautifully evidenced in the love God had for us on the cross. And Pope Benedict said that the church has never been against Eros.
God created it.
God created it. It's his idea. It's a good idea. And Friedrich Nietzsche, the 19th century philosopher, who is also an atheist, said that the church poisoned Eros. And far from it, the church highly esteems Eros, but puts it in its proper context. It's we who messed up, on our own, messed up Eros, because we do tend to turn it into its opposite, which is, as we saw earlier, lust. Because even Eros needs, Pope Benedict taught, to be connected to, or better still, to be
purified
by agape. And in any love relationship, we tend to start with Eros, you know, that chemistry, that zing, that dip, that attraction. But then that needs to mature into agape. And the other forms of love need to be present in marriage as well. The affection, the sense of being brother or sister.
Just one thing I wanted to point out here too is that actually God has all of these kinds of love for us. He has an affectionate kind of love, a family kind of love, a father for a child.
And Jesus calls us his brothers and sisters.
Yes. And that filial love, there's that brotherly or friendship kind of love. He calls us friends and brothers. God has an arrow. We see this most clearly in Song of Songs, that God has been pursuing passionate love for every person that he's created. I mean, every one of us is passionately loved by God. And he wooed us. And he there's that deep desire. And even, you know, a romancing, a wooing. God loves us so much. And then, of course, the agape love, which we see most clearly on the cross. That he's willing to pour out his whole self, empty himself of all his power, and become man, while still retaining, you know, the two natures of God. That's Jesus, right? So that's one thing that comes to me.
And you see these in marriage, right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking, agape.
All of them in marriage.
And agape, like parents with child,
yes.
that is ill, and how they absolutely sacrifice for the love of each other and for the love of that child.
Yeah. So it is good to kind of break down these types and see them.
You're kind of related to this. Are the three types of friendship that Aristotle identified. And John Paul II talks about this in his book, Love and Responsibility. And the first is utilitarian friendship, and this is where I enter into the relationship, principally for what use I get out of it. And it's really about me and the use that I get out of it. It doesn't have to be evil or crass. I mean, in a sense, I have a utilitarian relationship with my teller, my bank teller. You know, I mean, I'm there to do business, and once I've taken care of business, then I'm gone and I don't, you know. It's not a long lasting, it's not a satisfying relationship. The second level of friendship, it can be crass and using, where I enter into a relationship to really use the other person. The second type of relationship or friendship is pleasure. And this is where my friend and I enjoy doing something together. And it can be something good. I mean, maybe you and I both like hockey, and we're on the same hockey team. But then you break your leg, and I don't see you all season because our friendship is really about hockey. And, again, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's not deep, it's not satisfying, it's not long-lasting. And the third level of friendship that Aristotle identified was the noble friendship, or the virtuous friendship, the true friendship. And that's where I'm in this relationship, not for what I can get out of it in terms of use or pleasure, but I'm in this relationship for for the sake of both relationship and my friend. Because I'm trying to stir her up to great things, to some noble ideal, and she's trying to help me get there too. It's like there's this something transcendent, something beyond us that we're both trying to achieve, and we have to help each other get there.
Frodo and Sam.
Here we go. We're going to save the Shire.
And we may have to go along doom to do. But for the Christian couple, that point on the horizon that we're trying to get to is heaven. And we're trying to bring each other and our children and anybody else who comes our way along with us.
Okay. Questions?
Complaints.
Comments? Or just an area that something we touched on that you just like to talk a little bit more about?
I think I'd like you to talk more about the education. We have procreation and education of children. Most parents procreate very well, but they don't educate.
That's true. You know, Pope Benedict, when he was still Cardinal Ratzinger, just rooted the fact that a cohesive catechesis of the church, of the faith, has broken down in the last 50 years. And so that's why I'm glad people like Darlene and your sponsors are working to reestablish a cohesive introduction to the Catholic faith so that we can pass this on to our friends and our children. Carol is cut. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if this is what you're going to say.
Yes.
You've
been married for 32 years.
That's funny. Just today, actually, I was at a meeting for this Sacramental Education Initiative, and that's something that Archbishop Smith has started up in throughout the Archdiocese. But so we have a meeting at our church today, and we were talking about this very issue. But, you know, there's people who've got their kids in Catholic schools, and they want their kids to receive the sacrament. But they're not even sure, like, because I've had several people, well, at least a few people, who've kind of said, well, now, I'm not sure which sacraments I want them to get. I think it's maybe confirmation or communion, or what's the difference between them? You know, I mean, people don't know the faith. They really don't. And so, you are all very blessed, because you're getting a really good, solid overview of the faith. I was just talking with a couple during the break and just saying, you know, it's so amazing. We get to keep learning and learning and learning. When we've been Catholic for almost 10 years now, like, almost every day. I mean, like, we're just learning new things because it's so big, and deeper you go, the more big it seems, and the more beautiful, the more you think, oh, there's so much more to learn. And so, but you have to get people to that point where they know enough that they start really wanting to know more, right? And so anyway, I think that's maybe a clue. I mean, that I think somehow we need to help people get to the point where they at least have the basics and a little bit more so that they really want, they desire to know more. There is a duty to educate, but maybe the duty isn't enough. Like, I think maybe there needs to be that passion too.
And that passion doesn't arise just from acquiring knowledge, but it's really about a personal relationship with God, you know, with Christ. And as you gain this information, you grow in your relationship with Christ, with the Church, with Our Lady, and then you can't have enough of it. You have enough of Him and enough of her, right? So that's, we have to get people excited about that lifelong journey with God.
Then it will naturally flow. Mm-hmm. I mean, then you're at home, and because Jesus, you love Him so much, you of course want to talk with your kids about Him, right? Mm-hmm. And so until people are at that point, it's really difficult, right? So I think prayer, I mean, Jesus says, apart from me, you can do nothing. I mean, a lot of us, I think, in this room probably would just say, oh, I wish that we could, you know, just evangelize the whole world or the whole community or something. But really, we need to pray, I think, primarily, and love. Pray and love, pray and love. And then whenever we have the opportunity, teach.
Yeah.
You know?
So there's a breakdown that happened, you know, in the end of the 60s and in the 70s, where many religious sisters lost their vocation. And You know, I mean, we have far fewer nuns and sisters today than we did then. We have fewer priests, a lot less seminarians. And
it's starting to come.
We're starting to rebound, you know, praise God. But where the biggest falling off has been in teaching nuns. We've lost 84% of teaching nuns since the late 60s. And that has been taken over by lay people, and thank God for that. But there were, you know, people always give the nuns a bad rap. But there are a lot of holy and happy nuns who taught the faith, and the kids got it.
And they were the teachers.
And they
the
were
Catholic
the teachers.
School.
Yeah.
They were the teachers in the Catholic school.
Catholic school.
And when that all kind of collapsed, there wasn't anything in place to replace them, right? And so everything kind of fell on parents who themselves eventually weren't well catechized. Mm-hmm. And also too, just the style. Like, it used to be, you could go to Mass and hear a long sermon that had a lot of teaching in it. Well, the style today is like an 8-minute sermon. You can't do a lot of damage in 8 minutes. You know, that's like, you know, and so you have to attend other things, read books, do what you're doing to learn the faith.
I just wanted to draw attention, this is okay, Darwin, to some brochures that we brought along.
Yes.
Because these hit some of the topics that people struggle with the most. So one is titled Homosexuality, Is the Church Unfair? Really good. It explains what the church teaches and why. Very good. So you'll get a copy. Then there's, let's see, what's the next one? One on pornography, which is a huge, like we do a lot of marriage coaching. This is actually a huge issue that breaks down marriages. And also harms men and their sex drive. It harms women. One on pornography. One on modesty. And what is modesty, really? And why is that important? It, really, really good. Especially, you know, people talking to teenage girls. Well, no, anybody, really. It's really, really good.
For teenage boys with their pants down around here.
Or sometimes we go into the school and it's kind of like, when did they start wearing lingerie?
I wouldn't wear that in the bedroom.
No, it's bad. So anyway, okay, so that one, and then there's one on chastity and dating, how far is too far? And then one on cohabitation, should we live together? And that has, I mean, these have social science stats too. Like, for instance, why is it that those who cohabit have a higher rate of divorce? Like you would think. Well, you know, you're kind of given a test drive here, and so we're checking this out.
You're not buying a car.
But anyway, but again, because most of the couples that we work with are, you know, are cohabiting. And so we have the opportunity to, through marriage preparation, to talk about, just one basic thing, because there's so many things to say about it, but basically is that there's a diminishment of freedom. And again, we're saying that freedom is so important to love. If I said to Paul, you have to love me, I'm forcing you to love me, that wouldn't really be love. Freedom is so essential to love, and it's so essential to marriage that we don't want to diminish our freedom by feeling forced that, oh, we've been living together for 5 years, so, you know, my parents are starting to really, you know, feeling pressure from outsiders, feeling like I wouldn't want to break up with him, even though I'm not sure that we're meant to be married. It diminishes our freedom. Maybe own a house together, whatever.
And as awkward as it is, we encourage couples to move apart from each other until the wedding. And if that's impossible, to sleep in different bedrooms until the wedding. Right? And we explain that this is a gift to your marriage.
Yeah.
And it's not that the church is prudish, but she's very wise.
And highly valued.
Yeah, and highly esteemed marriage. And people get things out of order. Because the marital embrace, that's what we call it, this sexual intercourse, is to be a renewal of the vows. And until you have made that commitment and are ready to have babies, you're not ready for sex. And so we share this, and as we share these things with couples, we tell them, well, we didn't know about all the teaching of the church either, and we didn't feel condemned or judged, and we hope you don't feel that either. We just found that the teaching was
very compelling. It was very compelling.
And beautiful. And so we adjusted our lives accordingly when we learned what the church taught.
And really, it's that love is harmed whenever there's we don't want to harm love. We want it to flourish. All those different types of love, we want them to flourish. And so sex outside of the way God has designed it, because again, He's the designer, He's the author, so He has the authority. So whenever we're going against His plan, then we're harming love. Which is, it's hard to teach this because our whole culture is very wrapped up in, it's one of the strongest religions in our world today, really, is humanism. And like, you can tell me maybe that it's wrong to lie or that it's wrong to kill, but don't say anything about what's wrong in sexuality. Like, nobody is going to tell me, right? And again, it's that sin, kind of like Adam and Eve, like, no, I don't want you to be God. I want to be God here, right? So, some of these teachings are hard. Here's another one on birth control. There's six of them. Something to read, like read them carefully. They're quite well written. And then come to class and ask more questions. We won't be here, but there's lots of people who know that. Yeah.
This is actually just an interesting point about birth control.
Yeah.
Like, scientifically, that will mess you up.
Yeah.
Like, because you have this natural fluctuation of progesterone and estrogen in your body that causes the release of an egg at your fertile time of the month, which is about 2 to 4 days, depending. So, like, when you, because it's synthetic estrogen and progesterone which you're putting in your body, what happens is your cycle gets out of whack, and your menstrual cycle gets out of whack, your hormones can do things like make you gain crazy amounts of weight, give you weird mood swings, and also another thing that happens, it causes cancer, it can cause a lot of other mutations in your body because we have a very careful hormone regulation balance in our body. And another thing that happens is your body gets excess of estrogen, and that's going into the environment, and there is actual, like, gender balance in nature is getting messed up now because they're like boyfish,
yeah,
girlfish now because there's so much estrogen.
Or the boy and girlfish.
Yeah, like, and now our water supply is producing synthetic estrogen and progesterone, and that's causing actual, like, young girls are getting their periods earlier, like grade 4, it's going to hit menopause early if that happens. Like, it's just messed up.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Margarine. It's not nice to fool Mother Nature either.
You're
dating
yourself.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
No, I remember that.
I was talking to a young guy today, he said, you were what, 46 times?
He was trying to get his health
care. Add 12 years to that.
Anyway, but no, that's exactly true. Thank you for bringing those things up. Because it is true. That's another thing. Whenever we're going against God's will, His design, we are causing harm. I mean, like, it's set up in this beautiful way, and then we say, no, I don't think I'm going to listen to God, and then I'm going to go this way. And you know, and maybe there's certainly we can find pleasure, or it can be, you know, a thrill or whatever, but the point is that true love and true joy and true peace are caught up in this God's design. And so we don't want to harm love by these counterfeits. Other questions, points? Yes.
Just would you guys touch on how natural time planning and the abstinence part of it can enhance marriage?
Oh, good. Okay. So the question is, how can natural family planning and abstinence enhance marriage? I think part of it is, there's a lot of answers. And maybe I should even have Gene talk. But for sure, one of the main ways is that it gets a couple talking regularly about their openness to children. It also really helps women know that they're respected and that their bodies are respected and they're not having to do anything that might harm them physically. There's abstinence. I think it's really important for, you know, and probably again, especially women, to really know, not just kind of guess, but to know that they're not being used for pleasure, but that this is a really beautiful, sacred
gift.
Is a gift.
And when you're saying abstinence, you're saying you're choosing to abstain your child.
Yes. There, thank you, Jean.
So on average, it would be about 10 days out of every cycle that would be considered the fertile time period. So there is a time period that you have to abstain if you want to avoid pregnancy. But yeah, it can. I think it brings a lot to a marriage because you're not just looking at each other as the sexual object of my desire. It gives you a time period to actually build and develop your relationship and sometimes bring back some of the romance that you maybe had when you first met. But especially as you get into a family with lots of children and lots of other responsibilities and jobs, you sometimes forget to take that time for each other. And it actually gives you that time to look at each other and maybe do some of those romantic things that you did when you first knew each other. And so, yeah, it just gets to that time.
And mowing the lawn.
Yeah.
No, yes.
I always say it's, you know, those little notes in the lawn, you could always put the main book. When did you ever put notes in my lawn? But those are the things you could do. And just so that then when you can't have, when that time of absence is over, you've developed a love relationship and enhanced that love relationship so that when you do come into course again, it's a real celebration of that love relationship that you've continued to develop and build.
There are different methods of graphing, you know, a woman's body. And again, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a mathematician, but when I saw it on graph paper, it just moved me. But again, it was just, you know, you're taking your oral temperature, you're plotting that along with a couple of other indicators that you can use as well. But I could see a beautiful rhythm just with my oral temperature. But now, having taught this a couple times, this particular class a couple times over the years, and as science has progressed, there are products out there like the Clear Blue, you know, the pregnancy indicators, they can indicate pregnancy within a couple of days. So they can tell you where your frequency is. And I've added that information to the bottom, to the back side of this sheet, including what I call a happy camper from a previous RCIA who is now got two children now. She went through hell and high water to do this right, and she's a source. So we've got people here in the church, here in the classroom, that can help you either A, learn how to, you know, postpone pregnancy, or how to get pregnant, okay, in a very natural way. And it's way better than putting 21 pills in your body in 8 days.
Two things actually, one, just with the birth control thing, it did almost kill me. So, blood clots. So, the warnings that they put on there, they are true.
Yeah.
And if you watch them, anyway. And to change your subject as well, I was because priests are not allowed to marry.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know you kind of touched on it a little bit, but with that priest should be married to his congregation, but is there more to it than that, and will it change? Or
Good question. Well, having been married to a pastor, because right, my husband is a pastor for 16 years.
17.
So, I see some of the wisdom in the church, right? Because I know that, you know, Paul's married to me, but in a way he's also married to the parish. And so he'd feel tugged when he was at work. He'd be thinking, oh, I should be at home and be with my wife and these young kids. And vice versa, when he was at home, he'd be thinking, oh, I should be visiting so-and-so. That's one practical end. But again, there's wisdom in the church that way. There are like in the Ukrainian Catholic, priests actually can be married if they're married first, like before they're ordained,
yeah.
Right? And also, there are a few Roman Catholic priests who are married, but that is quite exceptional. And it actually has to go all the way through Rome and quite a while.
And they're converts.
They're converts, yes. We know one, Tom and Kathy know a friend. He actually was our Lutheran bishop, and now is Father Joseph Jacobson. So there are exceptions. But the main rule is that the church chooses priests from this pool of men who have vowed celibacy. And there are many good reasons for that. And do you want to go?
Well, I mean,
okay.
Aside from the practical, there's the whole kind of iconography, the picture that is created, that like Christ gives himself completely to the church, the priest gives himself completely to his parish. And also, too, the priest is a, and the religious sister, they both prefigure what our existence will be like in heaven. Right? Because in heaven there is no marriage. But collectively, we will be the bride of Christ. And the love that Carol and I share now will continue in heaven. We won't be married exclusively to each other, but we'll be part of the mystical body of Christ who is presented as bride to God. And so the priest and religious sister live that experience now, and they are an emblem, a symbol to us of what we all anticipate. And now some of you are thinking, rats, there's going to be no sex in heaven. So I better get married now. It's like the song, in heaven there is no beer, that's why we drink it here. But no, there will be all the love and intimacy and joy that we can fat, more than we can fat, in heaven. Yeah.
Actually, I heard that the ecstasy of marital sex is supposed to point to the ecstasy of heaven.
Yes, yeah.
The ecstasy of marital sex points to the ecstasy of heaven.
Yeah, that's a good way to
put
it.
Yeah.
I just also want to mention that there are monks, so there are priests and religious men, as well as religious women.
That's right. Thank you very much.
Lots of people.
Just wondering what the church's idea is on chili treatments, like IVF.
Good question.
What is the church position on
in vitro fertilization?
There are many, many different techniques that have come up over the past, well, especially 30, 40 years. I'll first of all give the short answer. Basically, the church is opposed to IVF, and there are, and it is for anything that can help the couple achieve pregnancy with one man, one woman, vaginally. For instance, let's say a woman has endometriosis. There's surgery to help with that is totally legitimate. Okay, it's trying to help nature along. But when we're taking that sexual act, well, not even a sexual act, it's basically at that point it would have to be masturbation to get the semen, and then placing those in some kind of test tube or petri dish. And then, as soon as that happens, we have babies. I mean, we have human life. Okay. So, and then, oftentimes what happens is scientists, the technologists, are then selecting the most vibrant ones and letting the others die, which is an abortion.
Forcing
them. And which also then causes a problem. Then what do we do with these?
There are millions of frozen animals.
And then, there's so many different aspects of this. And then we have actually the witness from many people who have been conceived that way who are now saying, I feel kind of lost. Like I walked down the street and I wonder, maybe that's my brother, kind of looks like me. Because maybe, you know, because really, if you have a donor who's donated a lot of semen, you could have like, you know, 100 or more siblings.
But also, so you are talking now about
you're right.
And the additional problem is with IVF is that often there will be multiple pregnancies. Multiple babies.
Yeah.
And many times those little babies are discarded, you know, for the sake of the most
viable.
And so you have a whole host of problems that arise from IVF. And so the church teaches that every child has the right to be conceived by the love of the mother and the father. And they want to keep the conception of children as close as possible to the way that God did. And they encourage healing the body. They encourage, it's like the church isn't against technology. They're not against me using glasses. But what it does is it aids my body to do its normal function, right? And likewise, any technology that aids the body to do its normal function, the church generally has no problem with.
Paul taught a course at Newman on bioethics, and there's a lot of these very difficult topics, and that people don't always understand. Like, well, that seems mean. Well, obviously, if a child is conceived that way, we love that person. That's absolutely as much a valuable person as anyone. We're all equally, we all have equal worth and dignity. But the point is that each person also at home just does deserve to have a mother and dad and to be
received within the covenantal embrace.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Here you go, darling.
Absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much.